Greetings. I'm Key Lunyasha, and I'm here in the studio of KPFA with San Francisco attorney Robert R. Bryan, who has specialized in death penalty litigation for over 30 years and is lead counsel in various murder cases pending at the federal and state level. He is a member of the Bar of California, New York, Alabama, the U.S. Supreme Court, various federal courts, and a fellow in the American Board of Criminal Lawyers. He was chair of the Washington-based National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty between 1987 and 90, vice chair from 91 to 93, and served 10 years on its board of directors. Robert Bryan became the lead attorney for Mumia Abu-Jamal in 2003, although he began corresponding with Mumia as early as 1985 and met him in Pennsylvania in 1991. Good afternoon. It's good to have you back here in the studios of KPFA. First, I want to ask you, who is Mumia Abu-Jamal for those who may have never heard of him?
Well, first, Keelu, it's a pleasure to be here. You're one of my heroes, and I'm sure many people out there share my feeling about the great work you continue to do and have done through many decades protecting the rights of the downtrodden and to expose human rights abuses, and it's always a pleasure to be here at KPFA. Mumia's case is at a very crucial juncture. We're at the point now where the train's moving, and it's moving very rapidly, and at the end of the tracks is the death chamber and his execution. My goal is to turn that train around, get him a new trial, and get him out. The case, it could not be more political. The authorities want to kill him and shut him up because he continues to come out weekly with these incredible commentaries in which he talks about human rights abuses and many problems that plague our society and the society of the globe, the world. As far as his case, I'm sure many people are familiar with it, so I'll just touch on, if you'd like, a few things.
Want to back up just a little bit and ask you about Mumia himself. Why was he targeted? I understand he was a member of the Black Panther Party, that there are COINTELPRO files dating back to when he was in high school.
Mumia has been targeted since he was a teenager because of his work as a member and one of the leaders, actually, of the Black Panther Party. The authorities have been after him for a long time. The problem they've had is that Mumia is not a criminal. And so they had a hard time. They once kicked the hell out of him and beat the devil out of him. Some white people were beating him, and a cop was there and put his boot to Mumia also. And as Mumia said, he kicked him right into the Black Panther Party. And
yeah, I think they were trying to protest the presidential bid, George Wallace.
Yes.
The overt racist of the day. He thought with his school friends that they could go down and protest. And they really got beat half to death by some racists. And then he called the police to help him, and the police finished the job. So they literally kicked him into the Black Panther Party.
And kicked him into being very much an advocate for the downtrodden and exposing wrongs in our society. And that's what led him to being targeted in this case and actually being on death row as we speak today. At the time this cop was killed in Philadelphia in December of 1981, Mumia was a very well-known, very prominent radio journalist in the Philadelphia community. And he was constantly, like the old story, the parable about the child who's saying, oh, look, the king's wearing no clothes. He was pointing out the corruption and so forth in the Philadelphia Police Department and many other wrongs that were occurring. And he was a real thorn in the side of the authorities. And they said, one of these days we're going to get you. And they thought that by charging him with murder, putting him on death row, it was a very quick trial, rush to judgment, that they would hear no more from him. Ironically, what happened is, since he's been on death row, his commentaries are now heard not just in the Philadelphia area, as they were at the time of his arrest, and some national, but now they're heard throughout much of the world weekly.
Right.
Mumia's become bigger rather than smaller as far as a person speaking out against human rights abuses, and the authorities now know that the only way they're going to silence him is to kill him in the name of the law, to execute him. And so the case could not be more political.
Right. He's also written books. Live from Death Row was the first, Death Blossoms, All Things Answered. And the final book, We Want Freedom,
the story about the Black Panther Party.
Yes. Mumia Abu-Jamal, formerly Wesley Cook, was co-founder of the Philadelphia chapter of the Black Panther Party. And, of course, he learned journalism writing for the Black Panther newspaper and went on to become a commercial radio journalist in Philadelphia. Let's go straight to December 1981 when the officer Daniel Faulkner was murdered in the wee hours on Locust Street in Philadelphia. It was the red light district, and Mumia at the time was driving a cab. Will you describe that scene and exactly what happened?
Well, it was in the wee hours of the morning.
As much as we can know.
Mumia, I will say, does not remember very much because he was shot at the scene and almost died. It was dark, wee hours of the morning. He sees the cop had stopped somebody. The cop was hitting the person, beating the person with a heavy steel metal flashlight. It turned out to be his brother. He ran across the street to try to help. He wound up getting shot himself. There was somebody who fled the scene, but the evidence certainly reflects that this person was the killer of the cop. And Mumia really doesn't know very much about what happened, except all of this occurred in a matter of seconds. Shots were fired. When other cops arrived, Faulkner, the one who died, was found there on the sidewalk, as was Mumia. Both of them had been shot. The police picked up Mumia, rammed him headfirst into a telephone post a couple of times, stomped him, and he was in agony with this wound in his chest. Threw him into a vehicle and took him to the hospital and knocked him around there some more. They recognized him right off. This is the guy they had been after, they had wanted to get. As I said, he had not ever committed any crimes. At that point, it was decided at that point without any investigation that he must be the killer. From then on, the end justified the means, and that was to get him. And so all the evidence was shaped to fit him. We have discovered a wealth of facts that people who the police brought in to the trial the following summer of 1982, lied. For example, there was a prostitute in the area who testified that she saw Mumia shoot the cop. Well, what we have uncovered is evidence that, in fact, she did not arrive.
Was that Cynthia White?
Yes. And, in fact, White did not show up until after the shooting. She's admitted to other people that she did not see what happened, but the cops came up to her and said, look, Cynthia, we need your help. And, you know, we know he did it. We need you to say you saw him do it. And we'll back you on it, and we'll take pressure off of you. We'll help you, and we will not harass you. And there were various people brought in that way. For example, at the hospital, there was a wannabe cop, a security guard named Priscilla Durham. She later testified at trial that Mumia said he shot the cop when he was in the hospital. In fact, Mumia was in such a critical condition that he wasn't really able to talk. We've uncovered evidence that she later admitted that the cops said, look, we're all part of a brotherhood of cops, of police officers, and we've got to stick together and we need your help. In fact, the cop who was with Mumia at the hospital the whole time guarding him, that was his assignment, wrote in his reports that the defendant said nothing other than groaning because he was
exactly.
in pain. The defense tried to subpoena to get this cop into court to testify because they had the report, and he exonerated that part of that aspect of the case of Mumia. The prosecution said, oh, gosh, you know, we can't find him. He's on vacation. He's away. And, of course, the appointed attorney who represented Mumia at trial did no pretrial investigation. The case was not prepared, and he did
Anthony
not,
Jackson, I believe.
Right, Anthony, mm-hmm. and who's since been disbarred. And he did not subpoena this cop, and he waited till virtually the time when he needed him and said, well, I have a witness I need. And you know, the question was, well, why did you not subpoena him months ago? You knew we were going to trial. Legally, what we say in the words of the Sixth Amendment, it was ineffective assistance of counsel. But to be more blunt, the defense was absolutely incompetent. And what's interesting is that the defense was so poorly prepared that Mumia early on decided that he would rather represent himself. You know, he could not do any worse since his attorney wasn't doing anything. And he actually, there's a case, the Ferretta case, right on point, that held many years ago that one does have a right to represent oneself. And what's really shocking, and in 30 years of specializing in death penalty litigation, I've never had a case in which a client was tried in absentia. I mean, that's not legal in this country.
Right.
But it happened in Mamiya's case.
They banished him from the courtroom.
Exactly. And not only banished, but he could not even hear or monitor what was going on in his own trial. I mean, he could have been on the other side of the globe. I mean, it would have,
yeah.
Because they would remove him for a day or a few days and then bring him back, and then they'd send him back out. The only thing Mamiya did that was, quote, wrong was he would stand up with his, and you know him well, he's very articulate and has just a beautiful voice, said, "Your Honor, I would like to exercise my constitutional right to represent myself. I would like to have good counsel. I would like to have an investigation." In other words, he was objecting and making requests based on the U.S. Constitution, the 5th, 6th, 14th Amendments. And the judge would get angry and mm-hmm. say, "If you don't shut up and sit down, I'm going to have you taken out of here." And Mamiya would say something to the effect, "Well, Your Honor, I'm just trying to exercise my constitutional rights. Bailiff, take him out."
Actually, I witnessed Szabo. I went to Philadelphia and I witnessed the last hearing. I was appalled. I could not believe that a sitting judge could be as biased as he was. And I really felt sorry for Len Wineglass, who was handling the case at the time, because he was so disrespected by the judge. It was incredible.
I cut my eye teeth years ago litigating a number of cases in the South in which my clients would always be of color, would be before white juries. And I've experienced judges, once one who threw me in jail for contempt of court because I kept challenging him. My African-American client was acquitted, and I went to jail for 3 days because I stood up to the judge. So I know what it's about, but I have never, with that, even that experience in the South, years of fighting racism in the South, I have never seen a case in which the presiding judge was as bigoted, racist, and biased as Judge Albert Szabo was in this case. And the way he treated Wineglass and the legal team was horrendous. He threw one of the lawyers, Rachel Wolkenstein, in jail for contempt
exactly,
of court.
Exactly, and fined her $1,000, I believe.
Yes.
One quick comment we might slide in right here about Judge Szabo is that one of the court stenographers, unfortunately a little bit late, came forward and signed an affidavit to the effect, I believe, the judge had said in chambers, "Fry
exactly.
the nigger," is
That's
exactly
right.
A quote from Judge Szabo. Of course, none of this evidence has been permitted.
That statement was made during the trial, during the recess. There's a hallway behind the courtroom, some of the judges' chambers and so forth. Szabo was walking down the hallway and encountered someone and started talking about this big case, the biggest case of the century in Philadelphia. And he started talking about Mamiya, and we said, "I want to fry the N-word." He referred to Mamiya in the most offensive, using the most offensive term imaginable. Even aside from that, the racism of the remark regarding my client, he said he was going to see that he, in effect, was convicted and executed.
Exactly.
And I'd never seen this before. I thought I'd seen everything. It's out of central casting in Hollywood. If they were going to make a movie or one write a story of everything that could be wrong with the legal system and our judicial system and the death penalty, tragically for Mamiya, it's all in this case. Everything is there. Federally, I'm in the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, which is just below the U.S. Supreme Court. And on July 1, I filed a rather lengthy motion asking that the court accept some additional issues on appeal. And in that, I do use twice the statement of Judge Szabo. And one of the issues I've raised in that is the bias of Judge Szabo at trial and also at this hearing in 1995. So it's incredible.
And speaking of racism, what about the jury selection process?
Only one issue has been certified for the defense on appeal, and I'm trying to expand that to get into incompetence of counsel, the bias of the judge, and so forth. But the one issue, if I had to pick one to be considered, is the one on racism and jury selection, and we do have that in the U.S. Court of Appeals. It's what we refer to as the Batson issue, and that's a case that was decided some years ago in which the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the prosecution use of racism in jury selection is offensive to the U.S. Constitution and will not be permitted. And the U.S. Supreme Court in a Miller L. case
just recently, 2005.
Right. Batson was 1986, Batson v. Kentucky, but then Miller L. was decided June 13, 2005, Laurel v. Drecke, it's a case out of Texas, the court reaffirmed Batson in the strongest language. I think a lot of us were surprised at how strong. Mm-hmm. And so that's very helpful to what we're doing on behalf of Mamiya. Not only am I briefing and arguing this case on appeal, but also the NAACP Legal Defense Fund will be doing an amicus brief on this very issue. No, this is a massive issue because Kilu, the prosecution, systematically removed African-American people from the jury. And you mentioned that, and we have now, that's been discovered since the trial, a training tape in which they trained prosecutors that when you have an African-American defendant and the alleged victim was white, you know, remove every person of color you can, you know, particularly African-Americans. And that's what they did in this case. And constitutionally, that's just intolerable. Of course, in this case, being as political as it is, my adversary is the District Attorney's Office of Philadelphia, and they argue against even the things that seem like obviously they would not argue against. They argue, and they argue this. I mean, they're not claiming they did not remove over 11 people of color. But mark my word, when we do the briefing on this issue, somehow they'll try to find a way to get around it and not assume the responsibility of the wrongs that they committed in that courtroom. And that's just, of course, one of many. I will say this, Kilu, there are a couple of threads that run through the case from the time Mamiya was arrested in those early morning hours of December 9, 1981 through today. One of the big threads running through is racism.
Absolutely.
I mean, at the time he was arrested, into the jury selection, the judge, the whole trial, the atmosphere around the trial, and what the authorities have continued to try to do since then, and that's to put him in the death chamber.
By the way, I'm Kilu Nyasha, interviewing death penalty attorney Robert Bryan, who's the lead counsel for Mumia Abu-Jamal. Robert Bryan, is there really any evidence against Mumia that, if all things were fair in a court of law, would stand?
All right, let me say.
Do they have any evidence?
All right, let me say this. A lot of people, because this case is so political, a lot of people make statements and speeches, and they say things that maybe exaggerate. He was at the scene. He was shot. He was near the cop. There certainly was enough to charge him. Was there enough to convict him? Therein lies the rub. A lot of the evidence presented against him we know now was false. It was trumped up. People lied. People fabricated evidence. The cops lied, Kilu.
Right. What about the ballistics report, Robert Bryan?
And that's still an open issue. Police very simply at the scene could have done things. They could have tested Mumia's hands or at the hospital. They could have tested the pistols at the scene. None of that was done. Just basic police work. It kind of reminds me in Los Angeles in murder cases. Los Angeles Police Department, they're like the Keystone Cops sometimes, how they mishandle cases, particularly when people's lives and freedoms at stake. What we want is a total reversal, a new trial, in which the jury will hear not just one side of the evidence and a lot of contaminated evidence it was, a trial in which he will be represented, in which there will be a full airing of the facts so that justice can be done. And justice would be an acquittal and for Mamiya to go home. And my ultimate goal, Kilu, is a complete reversal, a new trial, an acquittal, and for him to go home to his wife and family.
I heard that. I'd also like to question the Arnold Beverly confession. Where does that fit in? And
we're not sure whether his memory is accurate, put it that way. There is evidence that somebody else fled the scene who was the real killer. His name was Freeman. The evidence seems fairly persuasive regarding him. However, the problem with the whole Beverly issue is here you have a person who popped up years later and said, oh, I killed the cop. Now, there are some inconsistencies in things he said, but being a person who's tried many murder cases and specializes in capital litigation, it really bothers me in any case in which somebody else says they committed a homicide or participated, and yet there's no hearing, there's no airing out to determine is what Beverly said, what is what he claims true or not. And there's never been a hearing. And at the very minimum, there should have been a hearing some years ago when Beverly came forward with this to determine, is this accurate? Is it valid? Is it reliable? And we don't know because it's never been tested in a court of law. And I think that's tragic. I think any one of the thousands of people languishing on death rows across the land, in any case in which there's evidence that somebody else may have committed the homicide, of course it should be heard in a court of law. And unfortunately, because the issue was so late being presented and dealt with, it's not one that's before the courts. And I might mention I am before two different courts. We have just appealed from the habeas, what they call a PCRA petition or a habeas corpus petition, which I had filed in December of 2003, was recently denied. And it involves fabricated evidence, police getting people to lie, false evidence, and Mamiya's innocence. Court denied us a hearing after a lot of briefing and a lot of arguing on my part. And what I wanted was just an opportunity to be able to go in, and the judge is Pamela Denby, Court of Common Pleas, Philadelphia. I wanted to go in and look at her and argue because I'm fairly persuasive on my feet in a courtroom. And she originally set a hearing for February 11 and then rescinded it and took it off calendar and said, well, I want briefing on whether or not you have a right to a hearing. So we did full briefing, and then she denied relief. And then I filed a petition for rehearing, and just recently she affirmed her decision to deny relief. So a week ago, we filed a notice of appeal. So those issues on Mamiya's innocence and fabrication of evidence involving a couple of witnesses is now going to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. But the center of the storm is the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. People might be interested in knowing Mamiya's status today and maybe some scenarios of what might happen to him.
Please, okay. Tell us.
People need to understand that Mamiya is still on death row. He has not left there.
Exactly.
In over two decades. The U.S. District Court reversed it as to penalty in 2001, December 2001, because the trial judge made a mistake in jury instructions. The district attorney immediately appealed that, which stopped that relief. It stayed that. And so he's remained on death row. So there are two issues now pending before the U.S. Court of Appeals, and that is the death penalty. And the other issue is the racism and jury selection, even though, as I mentioned, on July 1, I filed a very involved motion asking for additional issues to be certified or considered on appeal by the federal court. His status, in addition to sitting on death row, what might happen to him? Let me give you just a couple of quick scenarios. One is if the lower federal court is reversed as to the death penalty and our issues for relief are denied. In other words, if we lose across the board, that's the end. We certainly can go to the U.S. Supreme Court, but it rarely grants relief. It will even accept for a consideration only 2 to 3% of cases each year. So the chances of success in the Supreme Court are, in any case, you just don't
count
on that.
Especially the political court that exists.
So if all is denied, Mamiya dies. He gets executed. That's the end of the story. And the train is moving. Now,
exactly.
And people have kind of been lulled into a sense because we've been litigating this so long that, well, we don't really need to worry about Mamiya. Well, folks, it's time. The heat is on now. Things are moving forward. And yes, everybody needs to be concerned because his life is on the line.
The political climate is terrible.
Yeah, and things are going to be moving very quickly with this case.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so if all's lost, Mamiya gets executed. And I haven't lost a case before, but this, you know, and I don't intend this to be the one, but that is one scenario. Another scenario is if the court affirms the lower U.S. District Court and reverses as to the death penalty. That doesn't mean he's off death row. What that means, Kilu, is Mamiya goes back to trial in Philadelphia with the jury. The only issue will be whether he spends the rest of his life in prison or dies. Regardless of what evidence we present in the courtroom, we cannot walk him out of the courtroom a free person. In other words, he goes back to death row if that trial is lost.
Right.
Or in the alternative, the best he could hope for would be to die in prison, a very old person. He would never be out. So that's the second scenario. A third scenario, and this is where I'm going, is a reversal of what we call the guilt phase, either on the racism and jury selection or one of the other issues, new issues I presented to the court. If that happens, if we get what we call a total reversal, it goes back to a new trial as if he had just been arrested. It's a new guilt phase. We start on square one of the chessboard. In that trial at the end, and this is where one wants a prediction, if people will keep fighting and raising their voices on the injustice in this case, this is where we will eventually go. The outcome could be, again, that he gets the death penalty and goes back to death row. The other end of the spectrum, which is what we're shooting for and going for, is an outright acquittal. He walks out of the courtroom a free person, and he goes home to his family. The jury would have a choice in between those two extremes of second-degree murder, manslaughter. So there are a lot of things that could happen. But the new trial, we've got to get that first. All I can say is the bottom line is, as we're sitting here in 2005, Mumia Abdul-Jamal is in grave danger. And I do the legal work, and the people that work with me, and we do, I know, a very high-caliber job. What I need, this is a political case. It can't be tried in a legal vacuum or hidden in courtrooms. People need to demonstrate. They need to make noise. They need to write letters. We need activist support.
Mumia has a website that people can go to for more information on how to fight, and that's www.mumia.org.
There's a lot of international support.
And, I understand he's required reading to graduate in the high schools in Paris.
Yes.
And he's an honorary citizen.
Yes, he is.
That's
he's
amazing.
He's been made an honorary citizen of a number of cities. And it's funny, you know, I think about Mumia and I kind of laugh. But I think back, he and I laugh about growing old together. And you mentioned in your introduction that he first wrote me in the 80s. And we finally met in 1991. And he asked me to represent him, and I reluctantly had to turn him down because I had so many other commitments and other death penalty cases. My plate was full. He came back to me nearly 3 years ago and said, "Would you reconsider after all these years?" And I said, "My friend, I could not say no to you this time. Too much is at stake. I mean,
yes,
we're and I could not, in good conscience, say no a second time. This case should be important to people everywhere." And people sometimes wonder, well, why should someone in San Francisco or Berkeley or Oakland or Paris or Rome or wherever be interested? Because Mumia has become not only as a human being, as I look at him as my client, as you know and love, but he also has become a symbol against in the fight against the death penalty, in the fight against
injustice,
human rights abuses. It's as I mentioned, anything that could go wrong in a case seems to have gone wrong tragically for him in his case. And as someone once said, the death penalty is a privilege reserved for the poor. And Mumia did not have the funds to hire a good counsel, to do an investigation, to bring in ballistics experts and so forth. That trial, we get a new trial, that's all going to be different.
I wish you the very, very best in your efforts, and I thank you so much for taking this case, Robert Bryan. I first learned that you knew Mumia when I interviewed you on a death penalty special many years ago.
Yes,
back
yes.
We're
growing old, hopefully gracefully together too, you, Mumia, and I.
I know, but I want Mumia out here. I love hearing his commentaries, and I love writing to him, and he calls me occasionally, but I want to see him in person. I want to be able to hug him. So,
well, Kilo, I would say I'd say in my many conversations with him, if he had a list of numbered list of people he had the greatest respect for, I think he would probably be number one on the list.
Oh my goodness!
And I just want to thank you for your interest in this, not only the plight of my client Mumia Abdul-Jamal, but also the many people who are being wrongfully persecuted by this government. And just thank you for your good work.
Thank you so much.
And bringing out the truth into the light of day.
Well, that's my job, just as it's Mumia's job. We're basically the same, radio journalists, revolutionaries, and former Black Panthers. So we are the same. And I can't thank you enough, Robert Bryan, for being my guest here and for getting the word out and for taking care of business for our brother. We shall be forever grateful to you. This has been Ki Lunyasha interviewing death penalty attorney and chief counsel for Mumia Abdul-Jamal, Robert R. Bryan, who's based right here in the Bay Area in San Francisco. Thank you once again.
Thank you.